I'm neglected to mention that Justice Hightower is unavoidably absent on personal matters today, but he will participate in the deliberation of all three of these causes. We also have a high school class visiting from Bremont, Texas, and I'm happy to have you here. The next cause is an original mandamus proceeding, Charles F. Walker and others versus the Honorable Anne Ashby Packer, Judge. The court is ready to hear oral argument from the relators.
May it please the court, this is a mandamus proceeding. The plaintiffs below are here today complaining in a discovery dispute involving a medical malpractice case of an order entered by Judge Packer on September 20, 1989. There are two areas of complaint within that order. One has to do with a deposition on written questions to a non-party. The other has to do with a request for production to a party. I want to deal first with the non-party area. The non-party area involves an expert witness who was called on behalf of the defense to give a deposition. This expert witness was an obstetrician professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Dallas. His deposition was taken, and following his deposition, based on testimony in his deposition, a deposition on written questions was issued with a subpoena ducis tecum to the custodian of the Department of Obstetrics at the Health Science Center for information regarding monies that were paid into the Health Science Center for testimony of expert witnesses, and also with regard to obtaining a written policy that apparently has the effect of stating that professors within the obstetrical department at the UT Health Science Center in Dallas cannot testify or are restricted from testifying for plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases, but are encouraged to testify for defendants in medical malpractice cases. The UT Health Science Center came into the 134th District Court with a motion to quash and raised objections in the motion to quash to the effect of that the request accompanying the deposition on written questions was vague, burdensome, harassing, general types of allegations, also that it invaded privacy. A hearing was held at which no evidence was presented on behalf of those particular arguments. Subsequently, documents were tendered and examined in camera by a special master. The special master in the September 20 decision that was signed by Judge Packer found that there were at least two categories of documents which were relevant. But the special master, without having had an objection raised by the UT Health Science Center, found that the documents were precluded from being turned over to the plaintiffs because the documents fell under the case of Russell versus Young, a 1970 20-year-old decision of the Supreme Court, which essentially says that discovery of third parties solely for impeachment purposes cannot be had. The threshold issue before the court today is whether or not the People's case and its progeny applies to a deposition on written questions and the procedure that a party must follow if they're going to object to what's thought on a deposition for written questions. We believe that the rules make it clear that People's and its progeny would apply because a deposition on written questions comes under Rule 208 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. Rule 208 incorporates Rule 201 for a subpoena ducis tecum. Rule 201 specifically says that Rule 166B shall apply with regard to any objections with regard to what is being requested to be produced in the ducis tecum. That means that the rules specifically say that the procedure to be followed is the same in other discovery disputes that come under Rule 166, which means that the party seeking to shield the information must first of all make specific, precise objections in a timely fashion. Secondly, they must present evidence. If necessary, they must tender documents for in-camera review, and they must be properly segregated. In this particular case, That procedure was not followed to the extent that the objections which were made, number one, do not have in them the specific objection that the discovery is solely for impeachment purposes invoking the Russell versus Young decision. That objection was not waived, since it was not made. Since it was not made, it was waived, and the court never should have considered it and never should have brought Russell versus Young into play in this case. But
what
secondly,
what is the interplay of Rule 167.5 and Rules 202.08?
Rule 167.5 is the request for production that is done with a party. As far as I'm concerned,
with a non-party.
With a non-party, I'm sorry, Your Honor. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't any direct interplay between those two, and that one does not reference the other. They are two distinct, separate means of going about discovery, the same as with regard to a party, which means that you can either do a subpoena ducis tecum to a party or a request to produce to a party.
Is the standard for production under 167.5 different than the standard production under a subpoena ducis tecum?
Slightly. In that 167.5 requires that the party seeking the information from a non-party make some showing of necessity. It does not specifically say that it is a good cause showing, but it is some showing of necessity before proceeding forward in the court below. I would submit to this court that even if that were to be applied in this case, that was done. The necessity of getting this information, since it was presented to the court below, that the testimony and the deposition testimony was submitted of Dr. Gilstrap, was first of all in conflict with the deposition testimony of Dr. Brecken, another doctor from the same department, another case, concerning whether or not there was a policy precluding these doctors from testifying for plaintiffs, and concerning how funds were arrived or derived to these doctors in these kinds of cases.
So you need the information for impeachment.
That's correct. That's correct. We showed a necessity to get the information for impeachment. That's absolutely correct.
So even if 167.5 applies, the standard of it applies, your position is you met that standard.
Yes, but I think it would be a real disservice to the bar to say that 167.5 standards apply to a subpoena ducis tecum.
If they don't, then what's the use of 167.5?
The use of 167.5 is an alternative means of discovery. I think.
Well, why would you ever proceed under it if the standard's higher?
Well, I think there are slim reasons why you would proceed under it in slim circumstances, but I can think of some. I can think of some where you're looking for a very large document production, where you don't want to take any testimony from any witness. All you want is the documents, and perhaps you're dealing with a corporation or an institution. You may seek to use that rule in that regard. I personally have previously recommended in speeches in front of trial lawyers that they not proceed under that rule, and they proceed with the subpoena ducis tecum, because I believe the subpoena ducis tecum allows a wider breadth. In fact, this court in the Lofton case pointed out that Rule 167.5 or Rule 167 does not allow for a fishing expedition, but stated specifically that there is more leeway with discovery in depositions, and that discovery in depositions is the proper way to go if you're not focused. And that's one of the problems, is that you have to be more focused with 167.
There is no difference in the standard as it pertains to parties under 167 and under the deposition rules, I take it.
That's correct. The theory that 166B and the people's progeny should apply to a non-party in a situation like this is not just mine. It's been adopted by at least one court of appeals, and I want to cite the court to a case not cited in the briefs. That's Goodspeed versus Street, 526 Southwest 2nd 747 from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. That case involved the exact same procedure in this case, in that there was a deposition upon written questions that went to a non-party. The non-party in that case was a hospital. The court applied, and it was a medical malpractice case like this, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals applied Peoples and its progeny in 166B and decided that it applied to a non-party deponent under these circumstances and found in that case that there should have been specific objections, there should have been a hearing and evidence presented in that case. If I am correct that Rule 167 and the Peoples progeny apply to the non-party discovery in this case, then under this court's policy, most recently reiterated in the Rainbow Baking Company case versus Stafford, which was decided January 31st of this year, the longstanding policy of this court is to facilitate settlement by fostering full discovery. And that case cited back to G versus Liberty Mutual, which again states our goal in promulgating Rules 166B and 215B and our prior opinions interpreting these rules was to encourage full discovery of the issues and facts prior to trial so that the parties can make realistic assessments of their prospective positions. The point is that we don't have to reach Russell versus Young in the context of this case. Objection wasn't properly made. Evidence wasn't properly presented. The rules and the cases require that we be given the information that was withheld by the court under Russell versus Young, and this court need not reach Russell versus Young. But if this court should reach Russell versus Young, Russell versus Young has outlived its usefulness. Russell versus Young is no longer applicable under today's discovery scheme. Russell versus Young, adopted 20 years ago, has as its central focus that you shouldn't go out and get impeachment information until somebody's been on the witness stand, because you don't know what it is that you have to impeach. Russell versus Young was handed down prior to 1983 when the rules of evidence were changed and you could impeach your own witness. One of the considerations behind Russell versus Young was you couldn't impeach your own witness. Once you've taken a deposition now in a case, anybody can put that deposition in and anybody ought to be able to impeach it. I should be able to put Dr. Gilstrap's deposition in and I should be able to show, if the evidence supports it, that Dr. Gilstrap's a prostitute and that his opinions aren't any good. The rules require full and open discovery. This would facilitate that. Secondly, there has been a shift in public policy away from protecting expert witnesses as evidenced by the legislature's recent enactment of the Rural Health Care Act provisions, which specifically say that in a medical malpractice context, if you are not practicing medicine or teaching full-time, you're disqualified as an expert. The idea was to do away with those witnesses who are strictly hired guns. Impeachment evidence through discovery will help promote the policy of finding out who the hired guns are, establishing that that's an issue that's going to be brought up in the lawsuit, allow everybody to assess what kind of experts they have and where it's going to go in front of a jury, and facilitate settlement thereby. Let me turn to our second issue. Our second issue has to do with the request to produce that was given to or served upon St. Paul Hospital. St. Paul Hospital in the case is insured by Aetna. The request to produce concerned any and all documents, notes, memorandum, basically any scrap of paper that was in Aetna's files, St. Paul's files, or their attorney's files that had to do with a tape-recorded statement by the nurse that was involved in the underlying medical malpractice case. No objection whatsoever was made to the request to produce by the party. None. A couple of years passed. Finally, the party comes up saying that they have researched again the Aetna files, and all of a sudden they found a transcription of this tape recording. We then moved to compel the rest of the materials, not just the tape recording, but all the notes and papers and everything that would affect it. They give us a few more notes from the Aetna file. We then go in front of the court. The court has an evidentiary hearing. We say that there was no basis for having an evidentiary hearing because when there were no objections made, you're not entitled to an evidentiary hearing. The only way you'd be entitled to an evidentiary hearing is if you make a motion for good cause, to show good cause for not having made your objections, and present some evidence to that. There was no motion for good cause made. There was an evidentiary hearing. The statement of facts is lost and can't be brought forward, but it doesn't matter because there never should have been an evidentiary hearing. The court, after having the evidentiary hearing, required not that Aetna's file be turned over, although there was no objection made to turning over Aetna's file, but excluded Aetna's file from what was to be turned over, and required only that the attorney's file and St. Paul's files be turned over. Then, in what we just found out this weekend, the attorneys for St. Paul submitted ex parte, and this is attached to their brief, a September 8 letter to the special master stating that five documents were being turned over. And I want to bring to this court's attention my displeasure at again finding, even after the footnote in Barnes versus Whittington, that ex parte communications not served on counsel are improper, that I have just found out this weekend that in this case, for the first time, again, an ex parte communication took place, tendering documents that we didn't even know existed until Monday of this week. And that document reflects that there were two other items that aren't even reflected in the court's order or reflected nowhere in the record. This ex parte communication was never made part of the record. So that there were five items tendered. We were given three of them. We should have been given all five because there was never any objection made. There was never any motion for good cause. We didn't even know those items existed until this weekend. Finally, along with those items, there was submitted to the court, although there's not a file marked copy, and to our knowledge, although there's a certificate of service, we were never served with it, a supplemental objection. There has to be a motion and leave for supplemental objections to be filed. That was also improper. In this case, what happened is there were no objections made, yet the court held a hearing, took evidence, and then denied us part of our discovery, including a redaction of what was relevant information when there was no objection that would have allowed the court on its own motion to redact the information. We were entitled to unredacted information based on the longstanding policies of this court, based on Hobson case, based on the People's Progeny. There was no specific objection made. It wasn't made timely. And there shouldn't have been an evidentiary hearing. On that basis, it is our position that we are entitled to those documents that have been withheld. We were also entitled to have the Aetna documents submitted to the court because it is clear that there is a superior ability on the part of an attorney who has made a representation in court that he's Aetna's attorney, and on part of an insurer when Aetna is their insurance company, and when a representation is made that they've previously gotten information from Aetna, that should have been tendered to the court, and we should have been given that information as well. What's happening here is that we are not only having information that a jury needs being shielded from our discovery, but we are having information that should be seen by opposing counsel, ex parte communications, not even being shown to counsel to give counsel an opportunity to discover everything that's out there to be discovered. This has got to come to an end. I was here approximately 2 years ago, and I asked this court at that time to give me some help in getting some discovery information, Barnes versus Whittington. This court, in a unanimous opinion, provided that discovery information to me. Subsequently, there was a jury trial on that case, which in large part, based on the information that the Supreme Court ordered be turned over to me, resulted in a $2.8 million verdict. I'm asking you again today that you provide the jury with the opportunity to see what it is that's out there that's trying to be hidden. That's what our policies are calling for now, and that's what fairness dictates. Thank you.
Counsel, is this additional information being provided to whom? To the trial court, to opposing counsel, or in between counsel, or on the other side? I'm not sure.
Opposing counsel sent a letter ex parte with the documents that were to be reviewed in camera to the special master in the court. It's never filed a record, never served on us. It's, for the first time, appears in opposing counsel's brief, the brief of St. Paul Hospital in this case, a real party in interest. It appears in that brief in the attachment as an exhibit. It is Exhibit F to the brief. It is addressed to the clerk that was tendered with the sealed envelopes. It was never served on us. It doesn't even show any kind of certificate or CC on it, and it was never filed of record in this case, but yet it demonstrates that there were additional documents that were tendered.
That's the first time you knew about it when you got the brief.
That's correct, and we got the brief Saturday.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments.
May I please the court, Mr. Kevin Keith, Mr. Brent Cooper, Mr. Delmar Kane, Mr. Delmar Kane, Mr. Delmar Kane, Mr. Delmar Kane, Mr.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Keith. I'll respond to the latter part of the relator's argument related to the Aetna documents and the documents from the defendant's attorney's files. First, I'd like to respond to the statements regarding any ex parte communications with the special master below. The letter that is referred to was attached by me to the answer of St. Paul Hospital. To my knowledge, it was produced with the in-camera documents, as GLANS versus Medical Protective requires you to do when you're making an in-camera submission. You're to identify what documents are being submitted and provide that to the opposing counsel. To my knowledge, that letter was provided to opposing counsel. If it wasn't, that was an oversight, but it was not an intended ex parte communication. If the record of the in-camera production was before this court would have before it that letter and those exhibits, and that was not done by the relators, nor was it requested to be done. I do not believe that mandamus should issue with respect to the district court's September 20th orders, because there is not a complete record before this court, and the record before this court is misleading, and there is simply not time enough to straighten out for this court what occurred below.
Well, let's try.
There was an evidentiary hearing with respect to the Aetna documents. Testimony was given. That record, one, was not referred to in the motion for leave to file petition for writ of mandamus, and the existence of that record is not referred to in relator's petition for writ of mandamus.
Is that the hearing that was held after, even though no response was made or objection was made to the motion to do? Is that the one you referred to?
Yes. Yes, it is, Justice Spears. It was a hearing in conjunction with Aetna's objections to a deposition on written interrogatories, which was heard at the same time.
He says those objections were never timely filed, but were raised much later in connection with that hearing.
Aetna's objections to the production of documents from their files was timely filed. What relator is referring to is a document request to St. Paul, the defendant, and they did not object and I think, frankly, that was an oversight. Another reason that mandamus should not, pardon?
For 2 years they didn't object?
That's...
And that was an oversight?
The objection needed to be made within 30 days. An objection was not made within 30 days. The request asked...
From it was from the time the request was made until the objection was lodged.
There were no objections made by St. Paul Hospital.
All right. How long was it? From the time... When was the original request made?
In 1987.
So it was over 2 years.
Until what? There were no objections made by St. Paul to that discovery request.
You haven't made an objection yet?
No. And all documents responsive to that request have been produced, and that issue is moot, is one of the points I need to get across to the court today. And that's part of the evidence that came before the special master in the evidentiary hearing, is that request number 4 of plaintiff's motion to compel with respect to their third request for production of documents asked for all documents alluding to, concerning, or referring to the statement of Nurse Iris White. The evidence that went before the special master is that not only has the statement been produced to Iris White, of Iris White to the plaintiffs, but all of the adjuster's notes from Aetna's files have been produced to the plaintiffs. And subsequent to the production of the statement, subsequent to the production of the adjuster's notes, both the person who gave the statement, the adjuster who made the notes, and the adjuster who took the statement have been redeposed. The court's time is absolutely being wasted on this aspect of the mandamus proceeding because it is a moot matter, and if there was an adequate record before this court could readily see that.
What was the purpose of the hearing if there was no objection made and documents had been delivered? What am I missing here?
There were.
If I understand your argument saying this hearing that was held without objection from your part, at that hearing the document was produced and the issue was moved.
There were five matters before the court at that hearing, one of which was Aetna's objections to a deposition on written interrogatories seeking to more fully explore their files. That deposition on written interrogatories was timely objected to by Aetna, and that was the primary focus of that hearing, and that's why the evidence came in on behalf of Aetna that all of these adjuster notes and witness statements were all post-claim investigation notes. And the reason that I think it's being tied in and bootstrapped to this mandamus proceeding is that they have everything responsive to request number four, which is all the written statements related to or concerning Nurse White's statement. What they don't have and what they've tried to get repeatedly down below is the rest of Aetna's files dealing with other witness statements, other adjuster notes, and they're trying to broaden what they obtained in absence of objection from St. Paul in the face of timely objections from Aetna Casualty Insurance. And they can't do that here.
Why doesn't St. Paul have a superior right to the materials so as to compel production?
With respect to the files, I think Aetna does have a superior right to that of the plaintiffs today.
St. Paul.
St. Paul has a superior right to Aetna Casualty Insurance files. The important thing, just as heck, is what was asked for and what was responded to. I have attached to our answer a cover letter and the exhibits that were produced in an effort to recreate the evidentiary hearing that occurred down below to show this court that all of the documents, whether you're talking St. Paul's file or talking Aetna's file, have been produced, and that was so found by the special master. And that's why mandamus should not issue with respect to any further production from Aetna's files. And in fact, Aetna's motion to quash the deposition on written interrogatories, which was the fifth matter taken up at that hearing, is not expressly brought forward in the petition for writ of mandamus. I think what relators are trying to accomplish here is to accomplish indirectly what they can't and have been unable to do directly because of the objections of Aetna below.
What documents that they have requested do you resist production of present?
I think all that comes down to is that there were five documents submitted to the court in camera from my files. It's unusual that an attorney will expressly request documents from another attorney's file. It occurred in this case, and in the process of producing over 4,000 pages of documents, there was an oversight and that was not objected to. So I needed to put forward into in-camera inspection five documents from my file, which ordinarily would be covered by attorney-client privilege. Those five documents, three of the documents were ordered produced. Some of the documents, some parts of those documents dealt with the document request. They concerned or alluded or referred to Nurse White's statements. They track the history of the inability to find the statement. When the statement was found, it was timely produced. The special master deleted from three of those documents information that was not responsive and was not relevant at all to the document request.
So your position is that the controversy involving production requested of Aetna now comes down to two documents which were not produced and pieces of three that were.
Well, that doesn't involve Aetna at all. Those came from St. Paul's attorney's files.
I'm trying to find out from you what your position is on what is now being resisted with respect to the discovery requested by the plaintiff.
Okay. Nothing is being resisted with respect to Aetna's file production because Aetna put nothing in camera. Aetna has nothing more to produce. Everything that Aetna had responsive to their request number 4 has been produced, and that matter is moot. With respect to the production from St. Paul's attorney's files, we're resisting the production of portions of 3 items that were submitted in camera, and then 2 other documents were found by the special master not to be relevant and were not produced at all. And globally, I would point out to the court that, again, these in-camera documents have not been requested to be brought forward to the court so that you can inspect what was edited, what was not edited, and what was not produced in whole to the plaintiffs. Rule 50 of the appellate rules
prevented you from filing a motion to supplement the record, bringing them up here.
With respect to the evidentiary hearing, I made those efforts, but because the relators waited for more than 3 months without explanation to commence this mandamus proceeding, we were unable to identify the court reporter who took down the evidence and who retained the exhibits at the hearing. Now, I've put before this court an affidavit from the court coordinator for the district court of all of her efforts to locate this substitute court reporter. I made those efforts. It's not my burden under Rule 50 to bring forward a record for mandamus proceedings because I'm not the one seeking relief. But in their absence of doing it, I made those efforts unsuccessfully. And that is why, because mandamus is an equitable action, they're guilty of laches. They've also not brought before this court a sufficient record. And under Barnes versus Whittington in 88, this court said, you cannot show an abuse of discretion unless you bring forward the evidentiary record. You don't have before you the exhibits, you don't have before you the evidence that was introduced, and you don't have before you the in-camera documents. And for these reasons, I think it would be inappropriate to mandamus the district court on the condition of the record before you.
And the reason we don't have a record is because it was some visiting court report?
There was
a... You can't locate who that is?
That's true. And the fact that the order was entered on September 20th and the relators waited until long into December before commencing this action, and over the passage of time, nobody can identify who sat in that court on that day to hear the special master's proceedings.
Surely there aren't that many court reporters that are used in that, or all the district courts in Dallas County in this county.
There is a five-page affidavit from the court coordinator indicating that she went from court to court, and then they used private court reporter services, and then she went to the payroll records to see if there were any payments made to court reporters related to that. An extensive effort has been made after the fact to find that court reporter because the respondents wanted the record before this court to help clarify what the situation was below. They made no effort to timely commence this mandamus action, made no effort to bring the record before this court. And I think you should ask them why.
Well,
my time is up. And
they've already said because one's not necessary. Their
okay.
position is one was not necessary because all objections were waived, so they didn't need a record.
Well, we disagree with that, and our basis for that is in our answer. Objections were made by Aetna to the production from their files, and those were upheld.
May it please the court, I'm Brent Cooper. I represent Dr. Kreider, who is the defendant in this case, who hired the expert from the University of Texas Health Science Center. We're going to address 4 points briefly. One is, does Rule 166B4 govern the UTHSCD's obligation to object? I think if you read the rule, you'll see that Mr. Weisbrod's position is totally incorrect. Rule 166B4 says, in responding to an appropriate discovery request within the scope of paragraph 2, directly addressed to a matter, a party, it's limited to a party, who seeks to exclude matter from discovery on the basis of an exemption or an immunity. And again, we don't have a party involved here. Second, we don't have an exemption or immunity involved here. Rather, the trial judge determined it was outside the scope of relevant discovery. Second issue I'd like to address concerns the response to the waiver. The relators argue that the Crider and University of Texas Health Science Center waived their complaint. I think under the first one they say, well, we didn't present any evidence to support our position. However, if you read their motion to supplement the record, they confess, they concede that the evidence, the only evidence presented at the hearing were the documents themselves. This very court in Wiesel versus Curry has said that in many instances involving privileges, that the only evidence, and perhaps the best evidence, is the documents themselves. It is undisputed in this case that the documents were tendered to the trial judge, they were reviewed by the master, and the decision of the trial judge was based upon the documents which was tendered to the master and to the trial judge. As far as objections, objection to relevancy was made. Again, the whole focus of Russell versus Young is it's outside the scope of relevant discovery. That would encompass that. Now, third point I want to make is Russell versus Young. The facts in this case and the facts in Russell versus Young are identical with one exception. Issues are the same. The only exception was in Russell versus Young, it was the defendant who was seeking all the personal information to impeach the plaintiff's doctor. In this case, it's just reversed. They make an interesting argument. They say that Russell has outlived its usefulness and was inconsistent with the present discovery scheme. That's very interesting because the rules regarding the scope of discovery were identical when Russell versus Young was decided as they are today. It used to be old Rule 186A. The language verbatim was taken and put into Rule 166B, subsection 2A. The scope of relevant discovery is identical. In fact, at that point in time, or in fact today, the rule says discovery must relate to the subject matter of a claim or defense of a party.
Well, if I understand their argument, though, it centers on the change in the rules of evidence.
Well, in fact, if you read some of the articles, there's an article recently by Justice Thornburg. You have two, Professor Thornburg at SMU, there's two types of relevancy. One is evidentiary relevancy, and the other is discovery relevancy. That is, what can be discovered? Obviously, they're separate. The scope of discovery in most cases is much larger than the scope of relevant evidence, which can go into a trial.
I don't think anybody disagrees on that. But isn't the change in the rule of evidence, given the underpinnings of that decision, can you respond to the
I think
argument
if you look
of
at, counsel on that? If you look at Rule 608, 613, 612 regarding impeachment by prior acts, by prior inconsistent statements, you'll see that the trial judge still has tremendous control over the ability to introduce impeachment evidence. Now, there was one change, and that was you can impeach your own expert, or your own witness, rather. But the other rules pretty much are the same as they were before when Russell versus Young was decided. And so I think that's really a distinction without a meaning.
If you could impeach, if you were seeking discovery of impeachment evidence on a collateral matter, then that would be if that were allowed, that would allow a great deal of discovery. But if you are seeking evidence to impeach on a matter that's going to be directly an issue in the case, why shouldn't that be discovered?
Well, again, you said it's a matter directly an issue in the case. How much income Dr. Gilstrath gets from the University of Texas Health Science Center is not an issue, directly an issue in this case. It is a collateral matter.
But if it can be established, if the prejudice that the plaintiff is attempting to establish and show the effect of that on his opinion is revealed by a document that could be produced, why shouldn't that be produced?
Well, I think for the same reason that was expressed in Russell versus Young, later on by this court's opinion in Ex parte Shepherd. There's certain policy reasons that fall under this rule. One is, if you allow them to go into the very personal matters of an expert, the financial. For example, in Russell versus Young, they're trying to get checks, bank statements. you're going to discourage reputable experts from testifying. Second, as far as the judicial economy, are you going to open up the trials to having all these battles regarding, you know, impeaching each other's experts through all these collateral sources? Third is the rights of non-parties in litigation. One of the things, if you look at some other jurisdictions that we've cited in our brief, generally the courts exercise more latitude toward protecting the rights of non-parties because, frankly, they sometimes are involuntarily brought into a lawsuit. They're subpoenaed, and the courts exercise considerable discretion in protecting their rights.
Should there be a different standard where, rather than entering involuntarily, someone enters voluntarily for pay?
Well, this court in Russell versus Young said no. Because again, and later in Ex parte Shepherd, a few years after Russell was decided, the court says we want to encourage reputable experts to testify.
Let me ask you a question about Russell. It's been suggested that the doctor's deposition there had not been taken and that there was nothing to impeach. Whereas in this case, the doctor's deposition has been taken, and now they want relevant information about his testimony.
2 points. One is, if you read the language in Russell, it says, relator had not yet taken the witness stand, nor has his deposition been introduced into evidence, because there has not yet been a trial. The focus in Russell versus Young wasn't whether or not a deposition had been taken. It was the testimony had not been introduced into evidence. If you look at the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion in W.W. Johnson & Sons Produce versus Johnson, again, there have been depositions taken in that case, but the court said Russell still does not apply. I know I'm out of time, and Mr. Kane, I'm supposed to reserve some time for him, so I won't, unless there's other questions, to give him an opportunity to respond. Thank you.
Time left. I'm just here simply to speak, maybe in this case, for the University of Texas, which is a non-party. But we were brought in to bring documents, and I would like to say that I think that there should be a different rule for non-parties out here where documents are sought. And I think that the requirements of 167 ought to apply not only to subpoenas, but also to notices for deposition to bring in documents.
The Health Science Center in Dallas have a written policy that encourages members of its staff at the medical school to testify for defendants in medical malpractice case and discourages them from testifying for plaintiffs?
Not as far as I'm aware, Your Honor.
If they do have such a policy, do you think that that's proper for a public institution that is supported by the tax money of all the people of this state? And if they do, should they have a right to hide it?
Well, if they do have it, I would think that it may be that that's the sort of thing that someone should know, but I'm not so sure that it's the sort of thing that these two parties should know. There are appropriate ways to handle those sorts of problems. We have other methods. We're not a party to this lawsuit. We are simply an institution that has an employee who was hired. And I think that when this court says that anyone who is hired as an expert witness, that whoever is connected with him can be required to bring in their records and bring in all of their documents strictly for impeachment purposes, runs into some real problems, and perhaps in certain instances where it's not a governmental agency, it runs into some Fourth Amendment problems. Because I don't think that we can require, without some sort of a notice and hearing, people to go out there and bring in their documents because two other individuals have gotten involved in a lawsuit. So, to answer your question specifically, if this is a policy, and I'm here to say that I don't think that it is a policy, if it is, that this is not the place to air that policy in this lawsuit. There are other ways to air that policy, and perhaps that should be done, but it should be done in an appropriate means, not in this means where we are not involved in this lawsuit.
Well, what would be the appropriate means to air it?
Well, you know, I'm not here to talk. I would think that might be the legislature might want to look at that, but it's not. It doesn't seem to me that this party should be able to look at that. It is so far collateral. How could that possibly impeach this witness about anything?
If Rule 167.5 had been followed, you wouldn't have. Would you have any complaints still?
about, and if they had gone in and requested these documents?
Right. No,
well, we do have a hearing. We did have some evidence, and we did have a hearing. I think the issue here is the reason that that's brought up is because this really, in distinction to all the other cases that I'm aware of, is a pleadings case. All of the other discovery cases are evidence cases. Here, there's no question that there was sufficient evidence before the court to make the determination that it made. We have the relator's own evidence. He put in affidavits. We have the documents in camera that were submitted. There's no question that the evidence is here. The question is whether or not the proper objection was raised, and you're requiring, under Peoples, the individual to make that is a non-party. You're requiring, if we follow Peoples, you're requiring a non-party to come in at his peril to get involved in this lawsuit all of a sudden and make the proper objections, and if he doesn't, he waives all of all of the things that he has in his documents. That's why I say that 167 is important, because I think that we should give the trial court more latitude when we're bringing in a non-party in his documents. The court should be able to look not only at what the relator says, the party seeking the documents, but it should also be able to have wide latitude to say, hey, this is not in the interest of justice. We've got a whole gamut of things that it can look at. So this is a pleadings case.
Are there documents here that the University of Texas has produced in camera?
Are the documents before this court?
Yes.
I don't think that they were brought up, Your Honor.
They were, the University of Texas did provide the documents in camera.
Those documents were provided in camera, and let me say that the court ruled that I believe it was B and E through H were not relevant. Those were not produced. The other two items, they said, were relevant, and I think they're relevant only under the terms of impeachment bias. But though they were produced, the court did look at them, and the court did say that it was not giving those evidence, turning those documents over because of the relator's own statements in that they were sought for impeachment purposes.
Everything that UT had that complied with this request was tendered to the trial court.
That's correct.
Any other questions? Who was the trial judge that made the decision?
Judge Packer, I believe, was the judge, but there was a special master who looked at the documents.
Judge Packer had appointed?
Yes, sir.
Anything else? Thank you. Mr. Weisbrod, you have 2 extra minutes on rebuttal.
2?
I thought I had 5.
Well, extra.
Additional.
Oh, okay. So you mean I have 7 all together?
Yes, you do.
Great. Thank you.
Starting now.
Let me clear up what we're after and what we're not after with regard to Aetna. Part of the hearing involved a request for other documents from Aetna. There was evidence on that. We're not after that. That's not part of this mandamus. Mr. Keith is confusing what we are after. What we are after, and the part that there was no objection made to and there shouldn't have been any hearing on, is this request for production number 4. And it involves Aetna as well as St. Paul and the attorneys, because it asks for any and all writings, notes, documents, letters, etc., concerning, mentioning, alluding to, or making reference to, either directly or indirectly, the tape-recorded statement given by Nurse White to an Aetna adjuster, including but not limited to any notes or entries in any Aetna adjuster's file, any attorney's file, or any file or writing in possession of any employee, representative, or agent of St. Paul Hospital. That's what one objected to. That's what there never should have been an evidentiary hearing on, and that's what we should have gotten out of Aetna's file.
I thought I heard, I have it in my notes here, and I thought I heard Mr. Key say that everything under request number 4 had been produced.
Well, yeah, I disagree with that because of the order that was written by the judge, September 20. And the language is, as far as what was produced, It says, the court finds plaintiff is entitled to all documentation sought in request number 4 from the files of defendant St. Paul or its attorney of record, but not from the files of Aetna Insurance Company, except as they may appear in the files of St. Paul or attorneys of record of St. Paul. The court has been advised that St. Paul has supplied all documentation as responsive, and I might add, the court's now being advised Aetna has, but that additional documentation will be made available to the court for in-camera review. So the same attorney told the court below that everything had been provided and then provided additional stuff, and the additional stuff we just found out includes 2 more documents than we ever knew about before today. So the fact that we're now being told that everything that Aetna had has been produced, well, first of all, the court below didn't require any Aetna files at all to be produced. It wasn't produced for in-camera. Nobody's looked to see if it was all produced. I don't agree that that's moot, and it's specifically excluded from the order. They should have been produced. Now, what we do know was produced are these 5 items. We should have gotten all 5 items without any redaction, without any editing, without anything, because there were never any objections made. Timely. There was a point made that no objection had been made even as of today. Well, the brief shows where there was an attempt to make some supplemental objections, but there was no leave requested, and there's no file mark, and it doesn't appear to be, it says it was served on us, but we never got it.
The answer that was given to the question was that no objection was made by St. Paul, there was an objection made by Aetna.
Aetna didn't make any objection to this request for production number 4. The record's clear on that. What Aetna made objection to was the part of the proceeding that's not in front of the court. That was the specific request directed to Aetna. Aetna timely objected to those and put on evidence, and we're not asking for any of that. With regard to this request was directed to St. Paul. Neither St. Paul, Aetna, or anybody else in 1987, when this request was made, made a timely response. And I think the record's clear on that. So what we're after is an order from this court that we get all 5 documents as they were given. Now, those documents, we couldn't bring them forward because they were given back. They were released by the court. We don't have any way of bringing those documents forward.
Can you help us on where this court reporter is?
I have no idea where the court reporter is.
Do you know who the court reporter
was? Have no idea who the court reporter was. I suggest that from the affidavit that if we had made an application for mandamus within a week, they wouldn't have known who the court reporter was or where to find her. But I don't think that matters because, again, if to this particular request, there shouldn't have been any evidentiary hearing.
Well, so, you say the documents were released back. Two questions. One, did you ask they not be released back? And secondly, did you ask the counsel to resubmit them to the court proceeding?
We did not ask the opposing counsel to resubmit them. We did not have an opportunity to stop them from being released back. They were released back simultaneously with the service of the order upon us. And I might add, as I mentioned earlier, we didn't even know that there were 2 documents that had ever been given or released back so that we could ask for them to be put back in again. Until we got here. The other documents that were back are redacted portions. I don't think it's necessary for the court to have those because there was no objection that would have allowed the court to do the redacting. I don't think there's any reason for the court to examine the documents here because since there was no objection made, there should have been no evidence presented and it shouldn't have been necessary to review the documents. The documents should have been ordered produced. Because there was absolutely no objection made. Now, with regard to the other part of this, the UT part of it, there is a citation in the brief of Dr. Kreider to Price Discovery Objection State Bar Professional Development Program 1990. This is what's being taught to the lawyers out there today on objections. And they're telling us that Rule 166B doesn't apply to a 208 written deposition. And this paper says, while Rule 208.3 deals with objection to form of written questions, Rule 166B4 would govern other objections, such as objections based upon the information sought being outside the scope of discovery, non-exempt, the matter inquired into being exempt or immune, privileged, or the request being unduly burdensome, harassing, or extensive. For objections other than objections as to form, reference should be made to Rule 166B4. This would apply, for example, to requests for documents by means of deposition on written questions, which are privileged. This author goes on and tells them how to make the objections. And tells
who is the author?
The author is Mr. Price from Austin, who participated in the professional development program of the State Bar on discovery. And I'll make a copy of this. I'll supplement, make a copy of this available to the court.
That's his opinion.
That's his opinion. That's correct. And that's what he's teaching the attorneys who are attending the State Bar functions. I just want to say he also states in this paper, with regard to what we're after on Russell versus Young, that information sought for impeachment of a non-party witness is not discoverable. Russell versus Young. Query whether the Supreme Court's 20-year-old rule is still viable. Example of objection. Objection is made to the particular discovery request on grounds that the information is sought solely to impeach a non-party witness. Tells them how to make the specific objection. That wasn't made in this case. The objection made was relevancy. The court looked over everything and said there are two categories of documents which the court found were relevant but didn't give to it. What we're saying is those categories that the court found were relevant should have been given to it because no objection was made with regard to the solely for impeachment purposes, number one. And number two, even if that objection was made, it shouldn't have been honored because Russell versus Young simply doesn't fit into the modern scheme of things as it is right now.
Any questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Second.